Freedom News Hour with Jake Towns, Walt Thiessen, and Gene DiNardo, Thursdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Progressive Radio Network.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds.
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, and I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-host Gene DiNardo on this Thursday, November 3rd, 2011, and some of the headlines that we've been watching this past week. Herman Cain, of course, still trying to fend off the charges of sexual harassment in the past that are now haunting his campaign, although there's new allegations from the Cain campaign today, that it was Rick Perry's campaign that's behind the leak and that it's all just a smear campaign. Very upsetting video of a judge in Texas beating his daughter some 7 years ago has come to light and is raising a furor down there. Meanwhile, over in Europe, President Obama involved with the G20 trying to deal with the Greek troubles and the interesting fallout that came about as a result of a deal that was supposedly in place and then became jeopardized when the Greek prime minister decided to have a referendum on it. Also in the news, a couple interesting stories that Gene DiNardo has, including one about how Iceland has been very quietly in recovery without the help of the banks, and also how House members were giving a deficit panel a rare bipartisan message. So we'll be getting to that later on in the program. But first, let's take a look at what's been happening over in Europe, because this is a crisis we've been talking about for quite some time, and it is continuing to evolve pretty much the way we've been expecting it was going to all along. Today, President Obama, this is from a New York Times article, he quote, plunged into the fast-moving European debt crisis. The interesting part of the whole event from the public perspective was that when he arrived, he was greeted by a basically frozen-faced Angela Merkel, who was the Chancellor of Germany, and then the President of France, Nicolas Sarkozy, quickly swept in, grabbed him, and pulled him into a meeting. So there was no time for cameras here. This was a very serious situation, and of course that is what the case is over there. They're trying to figure out how to make the best of a very bad situation and essentially trying to prevent the so-called contagion from spreading. In fact, here's again from the article. In public, Mr. Obama largely stuck to his administration's official message that Europe's leaders must, quote, flesh out details, unquote, about the plan they agreed to last week in Brussels to deal with the debt crisis in the 17 countries that use the euro. But American officials, including Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner, were huddled in private with their European counterparts trying to hash out an agreement that, at the very least, would stop the disintegration underway in Greece from spreading to Italy and Spain, a contagion which could further stymie America's own anemic economic recovery. So, Gene, it sounds like the things are continuing to evolve the way we expected. The one good thing, I guess you could call it good, is that the major news media seem to have noticed that it's happening. And it was actually on nightly network news the last couple nights. It's like, oh, my God, there's a crisis in Europe. Who knew?
Yeah, the only media that I've noticed that's covered it is NPR, and they've done a couple reports on it. But I guess you wonder if the president brought his treasury checkbook.
I have a feeling they're not going to make an announcement about that one. I don't know
what you think. I don't think so. Of course, all the banks are tied into it through the various loans and backing loans. So, in one way or another, I did read. I don't know. You may know the figure that the American banks had on the line, directly tied to Greece.
I hadn't seen a specific number on that. Now,
yeah, I believe it was in the, I'm going to say 100 billion mark, but that's a guess. I shouldn't even say that. But it was a considerable amount, and you know, that's probably just direct loans. So,
and I'm sure that one of the things that both President Obama and Treasury Secretary Geithner are there for is to try to protect those investments, shall we call them?
Yeah, make sure those make sure those are the ones that get paid off. And
I wonder if the American banks were asked to take the same 50% haircut that the European banks were asked to take last week. I haven't heard anything specific about that, but
yeah,
that would be really interesting.
That's a good question, but I think it was on any anybody who held a Greek government bond, I'm pretty sure that's what it was. So if an American bank, you know, did hold a bond like that, I imagine they would only get 50%.
But supposedly the agreement was between the European Union and the banks. So it would have to be something that an American bank agreed to with the European Union.
Oh, okay. So this only concerned the European loans.
Well, I don't know. I'm kind of speculating here, too.
That's a good question.
All I know, though, is that this was an agreement that was basically sponsored by the European Union. So what role did the American banks play in that? And nobody here seems to know. But
and you would think you would have heard about it. I mean, but like you say, you know, they're not saying anything about it, so maybe not, you know, to try to get the specifics on stuff like this. I'm sure you remember back to when the Fed was doing all the programs, how long it took Bernanke to come out with stuff, and then they came out with little, you know, covered up accounting, so they didn't really show. And then finally, I think a lawsuit was brought against them to get the actual accounting. So this stuff is private, and you know, it takes place in the secret rooms, and we're lucky to hear anything about it, I guess.
You know, it's funny if you think about historically what has happened in terms of private transactions and private agreements that affected, you know, entire nations. Going back, say, 100 to 150 years ago, it used to be known as the smoke-filled room, and it was a political room where politicians got together and worked out a deal between themselves and then announced what their policy was to the world.
To the world, yeah.
Now it's bankers who are doing the same thing.
Well, yeah, that's very interesting, and basically because, well, we don't want to say bankers control politics, but...
No, we won't want to say that at all.
We don't want to say that. Even
we might want to infer it, but...
We might want to infer it, yeah. We want to stay in the air.
That's right. Well, actually, there are possibly more dire consequences that could come along, but we'll leave that aside for the moment.
Right.
You came up with an interesting story this past week, and we kind of did a little email exchange about it, about how one European country is actually taking a different tack when it comes to the bank crises. Can you give the audience the details about that?
Exactly. It became necessary. They didn't. I don't think they chose chose the path they took, but to read from the article, in 2008, the tiny nation of Iceland found itself in real bad shape. It became a byword for both boom time excess and recessionary disaster. After inflating its financial sector with a pile of foreign currency debt and risky combinations of short-term debt instruments with long-term loans, Iceland, which is not a member of the EU, endured one of the most unpleasant recessions in recent memory. The country's three largest banks, whose total assets were 11 times larger than Iceland's GDP, that's an interesting statistic right there.
Yeah. People don't realize just how deep in debt almost all the European countries are. It's really amazing.
Yeah. They proved too big to fail and too big to rescue, bankrupting the Central Bank of Iceland. It took them over and leaving foreign creditors empty-handed. Inflation in the import-heavy economy reached 18%. The stock market plunged by 90%. Between 2007 and 2009, according to the World Bank, the GDP of Iceland dropped by 40%. The Icelandic krona turned into a pariah currency, and even the country's durable aluminum businesses were crippled by heavy leverage. So they were in bad shape. And I got to read this sentence because we both thought this one was funny. The author writes, "A collapse of this size needs a villain, and it will surprise nobody to learn that libertarians who exert an iron grip on political and economic practice throughout the world took the blame, as they should, of course, because they have such an iron grip on political and economic practice."
I had no idea we were so influential.
Yeah. Anyway, so
did
it goes
you,
on.
Did you
to
get your paycheck this week? I didn't get mine.
Hey, it's going out from this end. Yeah, that was something, and I don't know. I think you're right in that he's just said that tongue in cheek, but
and tell our audience what the source is, because the source really does make a difference.
The source is, this is embarrassing, but I don't.
I believe it was an article from Reason Magazine, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was from Reason Magazine.
Yeah, and of course, Reason Magazine has a sort of a semi-libertarian bent to it, so.
Had to be kind of joking around.
Yeah, he was kind of pulling a joke on himself more than anything else, I think.
But I can't wait till we get that iron grip.
An iron grip?
Iron grip on political and economic practice.
Isn't that like contradictory to be libertarian and want an iron grip?
You'd think so. We're not not supposed to use force.
That's right.
But it's defensive, right? Anyway, as always, we had to look to the legendary Icelandic songstress Björk for real wisdom. In a London Times essay blasting the country's ruling conservatives, Björk laminated the way the boom-bust cycle had wiped out small entrepreneurs as big money pursued an oversupply of aluminum smelters, which was not a factor of a free market, but a product of public industrial policy. Prime Minister David Oddsson did indeed pepper his tenure as head of Iceland's central bank. So their prime minister was actually also head of the central bank at one time.
Yeah, man, that's not a good thing.
That'll happen soon here, with free market rhetoric. But that's about as far as it went. In their new study of the crisis, Deep Freeze, Iceland's Economic Collapse, economist Philip Bagus and David Howden illustrate how thoroughly Iceland's boom combined Scandinavian nanny state, which consumes 41% of GDP and features unemployment insurance that provides 3 years of benefits, with the worst practices of boom-happy central bankers and government agencies everywhere. So they were no great exception. It goes on to kind of give some examples where the U.S. Federal Reserve's promise to backstop financial institutions was merely implicit. The Central Bank of Iceland in 2001 gave an explicit guarantee to big banks, making it inevitable that they would become bloated with risky and ultimately toxic loans. When the predictable emergency hit, neither the government nor private financial institutions had cash to redeem the large number of foreign-denominated loans, while the IMF eventually cobbled together a small bailout package. For the most part, Iceland was alone. So basically, they let the banks go. This international neglect turned out to be Iceland's saving grace. The crisis ended almost as quickly as it had begun. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development expects Iceland's economy to grow by 2% this year and next. And that seems like a small number to us, but that's actually a historically relevant number to Iceland. And it was, of course, they were much higher during the boom. It goes on to say that Iceland's long-term interest rate, a not inconsiderable 8%, compares well with a rate of over 13% for Greece, which has probably gone up since then, I bet, which is astounding when you consider that Iceland endured a default that Greece, in name at least, has so far avoided. The difference in unemployment, 5.8% for Iceland against 16% for Greece, is even more striking. Iceland expects to have a balanced budget in 2013. And it goes on and says, so what's causing the recovery? The plain answer is one nobody will consider. Iceland is coming back specifically because its banks went out of business. That happened in spite of strenuous public efforts, but the removal of the tiny nation's colossally bloated financial sector turns out not to have eliminated all that much value. And then he kind of sums it up. It bears repeating that banks are not creators of wealth. They are places where you store the surplus value generated by the productive sector. In a very narrow circumstances, that surplus value can be loaned out at a profit. But a financial sector is the icing, not the cake. This should be common sense, but apparently it is wisdom so rare that it can only be learned in countries small and remote enough to avoid the deadly medicine of global financial markets, and on our radio show. So that's a great story. You know, I remember when right before the financial the remedies they had for the collapse, which is basically to give the banks a bunch of money, I thought, you know, this is a great time to get rid of all the fat.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, they told us it was pay up or doom would come.
And it's a point that we have made numerous times here on the program, which is if you actually let the whole thing liquidate the way it's supposed to, you actually get a faster recovery.
Which apparently happened in Iceland.
Which is exactly what happened. I mean, they basically proved our point. Now, this is not to say that there was no pain involved. Of course, there was a lot of pain involved. But the pain is only around for a short time, whereas we're living with the pain day to day, ongoing for, what, 3 years now?
Yeah, and they just keep pushing it further into the future. And they also, you know, every time they bail it out, they complicate it further. You know, they push everything to a greater extreme, and then it becomes even harder to let it kind of solve itself the next time. But
right,
you know,
they're basically ratcheting up the risk is what they're doing. They're ensuring
exactly
that when the collapse does come, it's going to hit us even harder. And that's the part that's really difficult to swallow when we know that the more that they do of this, the more difficult and the more painful they're going to make it for us later on.
And I think, you know, I think what they they understand the mechanism. I think what they misunderstand is, you know, they think they can just keep patching together and it'll never have to be solved. But basically, you know, they're protecting the banks. I mean, these are, what happens here is these are loans between banks, and at some point, like 3-4 years ago was one of the points, they can't repay them. Well, you know, I say tough cookies. You know, they made the loans, and they should have to deal with it. And I don't think that's necessarily, you know, I don't see that as economic doom. I think, like you say, they can be patched up. They can liquidate. You know, people can come along and buy their assets and go from there. And some people will be hurt, but I think a lot more of the common person is being hurt, you know, the way they're solving problems today.
And we should make it very clear. Among the people who get hurt are depositors. And that is not insignificant. That is a very significant thing. What I think is the best thing that comes out of a situation like that, I mean, again, it's not a pretty situation no matter how you look at it, whether you put the pain off or you do the pain immediately. Either way, it's not a pretty situation. But the one lesson to take away from it, if it happens quickly and because you let the banks fail, is that it becomes evident to everyone just how bad a system it is to let banks use depositors' money willy-nilly without their permission. Because that's the root of the whole thing. And I mention that because there was an article, I don't even remember where it was. I'm not sure I could find it quickly here during the broadcast. But it was an article that I saw where somebody was taking pot shots at Congressman Ron Paul, of course, who has spoken vehemently against the Fed and so forth. And he was basically lambasting Paul and Paul supporters for all these crazy economic theories they believe in, including what we were just describing here. Well, I went in and made a comment because he said very aggressively in his article, tell me this, where's this money that the Fed's supposedly creating out of thin air? You know, where do I get $10,000? Where do I get $1,000? Come on, tell me where it is. Tell me where it is. So, and he had this long litany of things that he was going after, and I wanted to avoid that whole thing. But I did leave a comment saying, well, if you really want to know where it is, I mean, basically the Fed created the money and gave it to the banks, and the banks are sitting on it. And
so he was even questioning this money production thing.
Oh, no, he doesn't question it at all. He was questioning the idea that we should question it. he was saying, we know that that's going on. Of course the banks are letting it out. That's what they're supposed to do. Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, that's what they're there for.
That's what they're there for.
Yeah, well, you know,
listen to this. When I made the point that the banks lend out the money without anyone's permission, he went off the deep end. Because the banks have been going on doing this for hundreds of years.
You've
lost touch with reality. Oh, my goodness.
That makes it okay.
Yeah, of course it makes it okay.
Of course, they used to do it without the great FDIC insurance program. And then
you want to talk about losses. Now you're talking about losses.
Yeah, you want to talk about losses because they went out of business all the time back when they actually did some competition with each other. And, people lost a lot of money over and over. It was surprising how many times they – and, you know, that's an interesting point to look at that because, you know, I think the FDIC insurance is just, you know, talk about a scam.
Well,
but what it makes people do is think that their money is safe, that
right.
It is actually there even though it isn't. And but before, you know, even before that, people would put their money in banks and, you know, banks would spend it and blow it and then they wouldn't get it.
and to this day, you can actually ask most people, and you try this sometimes, it's an interesting experiment. You can ask them, what is the definition of a bank that's too big to fail? What makes a bank too big to fail?
Really?
And you ask them that question and you just get a lot of blank looks like,
Well, they've never told anybody.
They never told it. I don't really know what it is. And so
whatever they want it to be.
A bank is too big to fail because the FDIC doesn't have enough money to bail them out. It's a revelation for most people. They don't realize that the FDIC didn't have enough money, and that's why the banks were considered too big to fail, because they just couldn't cover the losses.
It's a goofy system. And I think most people just assume, as you mentioned before, that's what the banks are for. You know, they're there to lend out your money even though they didn't ask permission. They actually, your money isn't in the account even though they tell you it is. And they're there to create money, you know, when you get to the upper level of central banks and all that. And people assume that's just, you know, it's been, like you said, it's been going on for 100 years. But, you know, they just think that that's the way it's supposed to be. And
interesting point, by the way, about that article I told you about where the guy was going ballistic.
Mm-hmm.
His main point in the article, well, first of all, the article was full of a lot of anger and rage, so it was kind of hard to discern a main point because he was kind of jumping all over the place.
Yeah,
it was one of those
types.
Right. Yeah, but the one point that was coming through more consistently than others is that Ron Paul and the Republicans really are supporting the corporations, and that this is all about supporting the corporations. That's why they come up with all these crazy economic theories.
Well, there's a problem there because he associated Ron Paul with the Republicans, even though he is a Republican.
I mean, well, Ron Paul's been trying to do that all along.
Yeah.
I mean, he's trying desperately to associate the Republicans. He's trying to claim that his views are the true conservative view, and I'm not so sure that the Republicans as a whole agree with that. But
Yeah. Well, they claim, you know, what the Republicans claim is conservative. I don't know. I mean, there are true conservatives other than Ron Paul, though you can probably count them in one hand.
Yeah, that's true.
They're Republican. You know, most of them are neocons, but yeah, that's I don't associate them with Republicans. I mean,
well,
I don't know.
The Republicans would be very the Republican leadership anyway would be very happy to adopt your viewpoint on that because they're desperately hard to keep him out of everything.
Well, and my question was why he didn't declare. I mean, he is. Why didn't he just say he was a Libertarian Party? He didn't think he'd get elected, or?
Well, yeah. I mean, he actually was the candidate for the Libertarian Party in 1988, I believe it was.
Uh-huh.
And as with all third parties, he got crushed because in the legal structure that surrounds the electoral system, any party that's not a major party basically has so many barriers in the way, so many disadvantages, that it just becomes unwieldy. Add in the fact that they also don't have the established infrastructure of party horses to go out and whip up the vote and so forth. Yeah. I mean, it just becomes almost impossible for a third party to compete.
And they don't get the funds from there.
Yeah, they don't have anywhere near the funding or anything like that. I mean, Ron Paul, running as a Republican, has raised many, many, many more millions than he was able to raise when he ran as a Libertarian. So.
Well, what would be interesting if he ran, not as president, I mean, but if he wanted to get reelected in his seat, if he ran as a Libertarian now? Because he's been reelected since then, right, since 88 or whatever?
Well, to Congress, yes. I was talking when he ran in '88. He was running for president on the Libertarian ticket.
Okay, but he's actually been in Congress for how many years? Like,
well, it's over 20 years. He was in Congress in I think he won his seat for the first time in '76. He ran for I think it was U.S. Senate. I can't remember what he ran for, but he ran for a major seat in Texas, I believe, in the early to mid 1980s, and lost that bid. And that ended up losing him his congressional seat for some reason I can't remember. So he took advantage of that to run on the third party ticket, and that's where he got the experience of being drubbed because the third parties don't really have enough muscle to do anything.
Yeah.
And then he went back to Congress again and won and kept the seat since then. So continuously he's been in Congress for, I guess, close to 20, 22 years now, and yet in the time before it was probably about 24, 26 years.
It'd be interesting, you know, let's say a presidential campaign comes and goes, and he runs for Congress again, he runs as a Libertarian. I mean, it doesn't matter.
Oh, I don't think he will. He's already announced he's not going to run as a Republican.
Oh, he's not going to run it off.
Yeah, I think he's, well, you know, he's a grandfather.
Yeah, he must be in his 70s, right?
Yeah, he's 76. He would be 77 if he got elected. He'd be a 77-year-old president.
Wow.
Which would be, I believe, the oldest president in history.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a lot of service. I mean, that would drive me crazy.
I give him credit.
Well, I told you I was trying to get the lady to interview that was ran for the state Congress seat and actually won it in Montana with no experience, and she ended up not wanting to be interviewed. But she served 2 years, I think it was. I think they have a 2-year term, and she was just, you know, she's just a normal person, and she's a great person. And she decided, well, you know, I'll go in there and see if I can do some good. And it just drove her crazy.
Mm.
It was just, you never got anything done. When you got something done, it was everything was like you had to, you know, pull teeth to do it and
trade this.
And she, you know, she couldn't. 2 years was enough for her. So
then, did she run on a minor party or on a major party ticket?
She ran as a Democrat, I believe.
She did. Okay, yeah. Well, that's the thing. You have to run on a major ticket, otherwise you don't get in.
Yeah, this was a state house. And you know, of course, Montana is small enough. She's from Billings, which is a town of probably 100,000 in the whole area. But she just went door to door, I mean, for months and months, and had some helpers. And And, you know, that's a lot easier to do in Montana, I think, than other states.
Well, it's also easier to do for, like, a state representative because it's a smaller regional area. Even if you're in a very sparsely populated area, it's still, you know, a relatively small regional area. So it's something that you may not be able to walk it, but at least you can cross it.
And like here in Portland, the TV local stations will actually have them do interviews, you know, so you get publicity that way that you don't have to actually pay for. And so, yeah, that's the state house. It's a lot. You're right. It's a lot easier. But you know, I give her credit. She did it. Mm-hmm. Got elected out of nowhere.
Yeah.
She said the other guy actually.
And that's a major accomplishment, by the way, because most neophytes don't get elected.
Yeah, and she said the other guy threw the election, basically. He didn't put any money into it, and he just wanted to get his name recognition out, so he didn't care if he lost, so he didn't even show up for debates or whatever.
Okay,
so that probably helped.
That helped a lot. Yeah, I'm sure it did.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, before we leave the topic of the banks and Europe, there is one other article to cover there. This is an article that appeared actually at the end of October, October 31st, and of course it was just after our last show. It's from Business Week, and it's entitled Europe Tries to Recapitalize Banks Without Injecting Capital. And this ties in kind of what we were talking about before, because the whole idea of what they're talking about in this article is they're basically trying to save the Eurozone without creating new investable money, which means, you know, monetizing debt. That's basically what it amounts to. And that is a very significant point, because monetizing debt, whenever the market recognizes that's going on, almost invariably leads to highly inflationary reactions by the market, you know, large price increases and so forth. So the fact that they were deliberately stating in the article that they were trying to recapitalize without injecting capital, I think was pretty much unnoticed by most commentators and most analysts from a news point of view, but it was really quite significant because
if they
do have to inject capital, so to speak, basically create money out of thin air, that's going to be a major thing. It's not something that the relatively young European Central Bank has a lot of experience doing. And it's not like they don't have any model to follow. Obviously, the Fed will probably guide them. You know, just, you know, do it this way, do it that way, all that kind of thing.
Yeah, just send them over here for a little, you know, conference.
Yeah, right.
Conference.
It's not like they're incapable of doing it, but it'll be a major change because they haven't engaged in it in any kind of large way so far.
Which it probably explains why the euro is always so strong, right?
For
one reason, I guess.
Yes and no. I mean, it's always dangerous to say that any fiat currency is strong. None of them are strong.
Relative to others.
It's a 99-pound weak compared to other 98-pound weak.
Yeah, the strongest horse in the glue factory.
But it's not all that strong because in the midst of this crisis, the euro is the one that's been falling the hardest.
Uh-huh.
So how strong could that be?
Yeah, that's interesting that they haven't been printing a lot of money yet. That happens. So it's a lot of forces are at play, I guess.
Well, it isn't so much they haven't been creating new money. Actually, I think they have been creating new money. It's that they have been making a point of announcing that they don't want to create new money.
Oh, they got good PR then.
If they're making the PR, they're basically trying to make the point to the markets, hey, guys, we're not going to try to get capital in here. We want to do this the honest way.
Mm-hmm.
Even if we really are doing it behind the scenes, we want to tell you we're not doing it. And the fact that they want to tell them that, to me, is the interesting point. Because the markets probably actually know what is going on, especially some of the top players. They really know what's going on. What they're doing is telling those major market players, there's no cause for alarm, guys. We're not doing anything untoward here. You can expect that we're not going to be doing some huge injection of capital into the marketplace anytime soon. So, you know, just relax, and we'll hope that by you relaxing, the whole financial picture will come back into a normal focus again.
Just blow right over, right?
That's right. Just blow it right over. Normally, when a bank, a central bank, makes a message like that, it usually means that they're trying to avoid the opposite from happening.
Yeah.
They're usually trying to kind of cover something over. So the fact that they went out of their way, the Business Week basically went out of its way to make it clear that the banks are not going to recapitalize by injecting capital, that tells me they probably are, and they're trying to make it look like they aren't.
Yeah, they're playing politics, which is interesting, because
why
should a bank have to politicize at all if they're actually a bank?
Exactly. Well, we're about halfway through the hour here, and we should take a break. And then after the break, Eugene, you've got a couple of interesting articles, including one that has a very unusual title. It says, Americans Don't Trust Their Government. Really? What made you think that?
I don't know. It's just an idea I have.
We'll have to pick that one up after the break. That's going to be a good one. Plus, we're also going to be talking about what's going on with the Kane harassment, sexual harassment scandal, and the latest news on that, so you want to stay tuned for that. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back. Yep, run back to your dial, because we're back here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. And just to remind you, you can always check out our website to find out what's upcoming on future shows, or to check out on podcasts from past shows. The website address, www.freedomnewshour.com. You'll find links to specifically about more recent shows. You'll also find links over to the Progressive Radio Network's website, where you can find even more shows over there. So it's worth checking out. Plus, there's a comment feature, so you want to take advantage of that, too. And getting back to the stories of the day, one thing I wanted to touch on, we have in the past, Gene, talked about the robo-signing controversy and all of the allegations about how the banks have been mishandling foreclosure processes and so forth. Well, it was announced this week very quietly that the federal government has kicked off its foreclosure review process. That was on Tuesday, and that's going to offer nearly 4.5 million consumers the chance to get their foreclosure cases reviewed for mistakes and potential restitution. A batch of letters informing consumers that their right to review went out on Tuesday. They will all go out by December 31st, that according to the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. A website has been set up at www.independentforeclosurereview.com, and consumers can also call a toll-free number, 1-888-952-9105. And this foreclosure review, it's covering foreclosure actions taken by 14 mortgage servicers and their affiliates in 2009 or 2010, was ordered by federal banking regulators in April after an investigation found significant weaknesses in mortgage servicing and foreclosure processes. The individual reviews, which consumers must request no later than April 30th, could take months to complete. They will cover foreclosure actions against primary homes only, and not every homeowner is expected to receive compensation. Remedies could vary substantially based on the severity of harm. That's what regulators say. If a foreclosure sale is scheduled and a review is underway, the sale will be postponed until the review is complete, that according to Brian Hubbard, OCC spokesman, and letters will inform consumers of their right to review and include a form to request a review. The reviews mark the most ambitious enforcement effort so far, that according to OCC, of course, and 8 independent consulting firms hired by the servicers but approved by the regulators will do the reviews and decide on restitution. That one's a little bit... makes me wonder a little bit. If they're paid for by the banks, how do we know they're going to be, you know, on the up and up on this? I don't know. But that's a rather gloomy point about the whole thing. In fact, that's a point that was raised by the National Consumer Law Center. Their spokesperson, Alice Cohen, said it's clear that the process is quite closed, and she has a good point.
Yeah, very good point.
A very, very good point.
Maybe they should have a little... small court where the people who have already been foreclosed on are the judges and jury.
Right, exactly.
Or at least throw a couple of them in there.
An interesting thing is that if the once the ruling is made, the ruling is final. So in other words, this is basically the last hope for the people who say they want to take a swipe back at what happened to them in the foreclosure process.
These are people that have already been out of their houses?
It can be somebody who's already out of their house or somebody who's currently within a foreclosure process.
In the process.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, that'd be, I guess what would be interesting and conclusive is, how many cases actually get approved and they say, okay, or how much money is actually paid out.
And they're actually only looking at 4 different main criteria. They're not evaluating a lot of the stuff people want them to evaluate. The only things they're looking at are, were the mortgage balances figured correctly? Foreclosure actions, were they occurring while consumers were protected by bankruptcy laws? Foreclosure sales, did they occur even though homeowners were in compliance with a modification agreement? And fourth, were the fees inaccurately calculated or applied? And that's as far as they're going with this.
So it has nothing to do with the whole title problem.
No, that's the thing. Yeah. A lot of it's just being wiped by the boards.
it sounds like they're just bringing that up to kind of detract people's attention from that problem. I'm really surprised there hasn't been a class action lawsuit, brought up in the courts against, concerning the whole Tito issue, and it's really surprising.
Well, I think a lot of lawsuits have been filed. We're just not hearing about them. I don't know if there's a class action out there or not. There might be one for all we know, but yeah. I do know a lot of lawsuits have been filed.
Yeah, and I haven't read anything other than what you mentioned right there about the whole foreclosure thing with the title issue. So apparently they've just swept it right under the rug, I guess.
Well, I guess it just gives Americans another reason not to trust their government, doesn't it?
It does.
And in fact, you've got more details about that. What do you have?
It seems like they don't. This is the latest New York Times CBS poll, and Americans' distrust of government at its highest level ever. This combustible climate helps explain the volatility of the presidential race and has provided an opening for protest movements such as Occupy Wall Street and the earlier Tea Party movement to highlight grievances about banks, income inequality, and a sense that the poor middle class have been disenfranchised. Almost half of the public thinks the sentiment at the root of the Occupy movement generally reflects the views of most Americans. With nearly all Americans remaining fearful that the economy is stagnating or deteriorating further, two-thirds of the public said that wealth should be distributed more evenly in the country. 7 in 10 think the policies of congressional Republicans favor the rich. Two-thirds object to tax cuts for corporations, whatever that means, I'm not sure. And a similar number prefer increasing income taxes on millionaires. It's kind of surprising only two-thirds. the income tax is so... You can never make it fair. It's almost like, you just want to protect yourself. Why isn't it 95%, hey, I'm not a millionaire. Tax them. And, a millionaire should say, hey, don't tax me. Anyway, earlier this week, the Congressional Budget Office released a new study concluding that income distribution had become much more uneven in the past 3 decades, a report that could figure prominently in the battle over how to revive the economy and rein in the federal debt. Then it goes on to say 89% of Americans say they distrust government to do the right thing, and 74% say this country is on the wrong track. 84% disapprove of Congress, warnings for Democrats and Republicans alike. Republican voters remain unenthused about their options to challenge Barack Obama next year. The approval rating for Obama was 46%. It appears to be elevated by his positions he has taken on foreign affairs. 60% of those questioned said they approve of his handling of Iraq, a question added to the polls following the announcement last week that U.S. troops would come home by the end of the year. But the president, whose disapproval rating is also 46%, faces mixed signals from the public about his latest job creation proposals. While the poll found substantially support for the plan's individual components, more than half of the public say he lacks a clear plan for creating jobs. Nearly 9 in 10 Democrats, two-thirds of independents, and just over one-third of all Republicans say that the distribution of wealth in the country should be more equitable, even as a majority of Republicans said they think it's fair. Congressional Republicans are viewed even worse than the president, with 71% of the public saying the party does not have a clear plan for creating jobs, and support for several other Republican proposals is more tepid than for Obama's initiatives to lift the economy. Only about a quarter of the public said that lowering taxes on corporations, on large corporations, or repealing the entire national health care law was a good thing. But half of the public favors reducing or repealing regulations on businesses in the United States. They said there was a remarkable sense of pessimism and skepticism was apparent in question after question in the survey, which found that congressional approval, the amount of people who approved of what Congress did, had reached a new low of 9%.
9%, I saw that.
The disapproval towards Congress has risen 22 percentage points since the beginning of the year when Republicans took control of the House. So it just seems everything they ask them, didn't matter who it was or what it was, people seem to be at a high rate of disapproval. And
So if you ask 11 people, 1 will say they approve of Congress, 10 will say that they, or I'm sorry, 9 will say that they disapprove of it, and 1's not sure.
Isn't that amazing?
That's really something.
It's a pretty good sentiment.
Oh, my goodness.
On what they've been doing or not doing, or what they expect them to do.
Well, it certainly works for me, because, I mean, I felt that way most of my life, but it's kind of nice to know everybody's coming over to my point of view.
Yeah, finally everybody's joining in with you. Get rid of the bums.
By the way, yeah. I don't know if you noticed, but we were talking last week, of course, about President Obama announcing all the troops to be coming home from Iraq. It turns out they may not actually be coming home.
Oh, get out of here.
They're being the idea being kicked around at the Pentagon is that all these troops that were in Iran should actually be redeployed to other countries in the Middle East in case something happens in Iran.
You know, I did read that. I read that they were going to move quite a few of them around. Isn't that amazing?
I mean, talk about, you know, a jab in the back. Here are all these families who are hoping that once Iraq is done, their loved ones get to come home. And now Iraq is done, and they don't get to come home.
Plus, they see it on the news.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everybody's coming home. They're coming home. And then that's terrible.
Well, last week we were remarking on how little excitement there is. Maybe they knew ahead of us. Maybe that's why they were not terribly excited. Maybe the families knew that it was just all a bunch of noise, and they weren't really going to get their loved ones home anyway.
Yeah, and this, you know, this is what our government does, though. I mean, we left Iraq, or when we began to pull troops, they immediately went to Afghanistan, right? I mean, Obama just transferred them over there. And, you know, now, as you say, there's talk of them staying in the Middle East. So we just keep expanding, you know, where we base our troops and our presence, and it's really endless. I mean, we hope it's not endless, but it seems to be endless.
It can get depressing if you let it get to you, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Well, thanks for the details on that. Let's talk about Herman Cain. Now, Herman Cain, of course, was the newest and latest rising star within the Republican Party. We have not expressed particularly nice viewpoints about him here on the show, but he was certainly on the rise. He had basically tied Mitt Romney at the top of the polls and so forth. And then along come these allegations of sexual harassment. And that's been playing out, I guess it's now over a four-day period, all kinds of allegations being thrown around, not a whole lot in the way of factual information, mostly just, you know, whispers and rumors and that sort of thing. And, of course, both sides are doing their spin, the pro-Cain side saying, oh, well, it's just rumors, it's basically just baseless attacks, and the other side saying, hey, there are three women who are ready to come forward, but they're being muzzled by lawsuits. I mean, it's been really something. And, of course, the latest today is that the Cain campaign has been charging that it's the Perry campaign who's throwing the mud by having raised this in the first place, that basically it was the Perry campaign that leaked this to the press. And, in fact, there was a Perry pollster who alleges and actually made a statement saying that he was at a meeting, a luncheon meeting, in Crystal City. Crystal City is near where the Pentagon is, just outside of D.C. in Virginia. And at that particular dining event, he and others at the event saw Herman Cain actually hit on a woman at the table in a way that, in his words, made everybody very, very uncomfortable. And Cain was actually asked to, you know, hey, tone it down, be quiet here, guy. So in his words, everybody who was at that table knew that this was going to come out once Cain became a presidential candidate, and only now is it coming out. But now the Cain campaign is saying, no, the whole thing is fabricated. And it's really interesting to see how specifically Herman Cain himself is stating that the whole thing is a hoax. I mean, he's starting to get very specific about it. He's not softening anything he's saying. He's not avoiding saying things. He's coming right out and basically tying himself to this so that if anything else comes out showing that what he's very specifically saying isn't true, he's going to be in deep trouble. So it raises the question, is what he's saying really true? And people really wonder.
Yeah, that's true.
Just to read from the CNN article, and of course there are a lot of them you can find online, but this one pretty much describes it well. It says, a defiant Herman Cain on Thursday continued to deny allegations of sexual harassment in his past and said he won't be deterred by the controversy that has dominated his front-running campaign for the Republican presidential nomination. Citing strong poll numbers and fundraising, Cain said voters knew that the allegations were a baseless political attack. They know it, huh? Okay. Quote, the American people are starting to see through this stuff and they are sick of gutter politics, Cain declared in a radio interview with conservative commentator Sean Hannity. This will not deter me, he says. Asked specifically about money paid to two women when they left the National Restaurant Association while he headed the organization in the late 1990s, Cain said in the one case he recalled it was severance money because any accusations of impropriety on his part proved unfounded. Kane also repeated his accusation that the campaign of Governor Rick Perry, a conservative rival for the GOP nomination, was behind the allegations emerging as Kane rose to the top of polls in the race. In particular, he noted that a former aide, Kurt Anderson, that's the one we were referring to, signed on with the Perry campaign shortly before the allegations surfaced in a report Sunday by Politico. These are the facts, he said. Connect the dots, adding that, quote, as more of the information comes out, the more baseless it appears to people. However, Kane later softened his earlier claim that he told Anderson about one of the allegations against him in a private discussion in 2003. On Thursday, he told Hannity he was, quote, almost certain, unquote, the discussion took place. The allegations, of course, set off a fierce round of claims and counterclaims. Meanwhile, one of two women who reportedly accused Kane of sexual harassment could possibly issue her first statement on what happened as early as Friday. Asked by Hannity if he ever made flirtatious comments to female subordinates or comments such as, you look hot or anything, Kane replied, no, 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 I didn't.
You look hot.
As a business leader, he said he, quote, learned a long time ago, unquote, not to comment on a woman's appearance or make any kind of personal comment unless he was, quote, really, really comfortable, unquote, with a colleague. So he sounds like he's basically laid it on the line saying, okay, I didn't do any of this stuff. I never said anything untoward. And then here's this woman who's supposedly going to be making a statement on Friday. This could get very interesting
tomorrow.
That
could be interesting. And, you know, like you mentioned, there were two people that were paid. And it sounds like he only mentioned one. He said it was severance pay. You know, you could – that could have been part of the agreement. I'm not taking any side, but, I mean, you could say, okay, look, we'll give you this much money. We'll consider it severance pay, and you just leave, you know, I mean – That's not unusual, but it's an interesting story.
And I saw another note. I don't remember even where I saw it. I can't point anyone to an article. It may have been something I saw on TV. I'm not sure. But there was a suggestion that one of the women who are still unnamed could perhaps be a spokeswoman for either a congressional committee or some organization that is associated with Congress in Washington, D.C. So this could be somebody who has some degree of public persona. If that happens to be true, that's going to make it even more interesting.
Yeah, that'll put a lot of it's not just somebody coming out of nowhere, right?
That's right. Yeah, that starts to – well, it also depends on what party that person's from. If that woman is a Republican, for instance, well, if she's a Democrat, then it just becomes an Obama campaign issued it or something like that. And that's the kind of thing we'll expect the Kane campaign to say. But if it's a Republican, then we're probably going to start seeing Herman Cain claiming that the woman is associated with the Perry camp or something along that line.
Yeah.
It's going to be, oh, my goodness. One thing I do know is that anytime these kinds of allegations start to float at the level that they are right now, usually you end up with fire following the smoke. And I don't see how this doesn't ultimately lead to a fall in the polls for Herman Cain, despite everything his campaign is saying. I mean, this is the kind of thing that can destroy a campaign.
I don't see him winning if it actually comes to be true. I can't see that. I mean, I suppose it's possible, but
it is possible. And if he did get the nomination, that would, to me, that would actually raise more questions. How did he manage to do it?
Yeah, then they'd be bringing it up then. And
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I think they, to tell you the truth, I think these political campaigns, you know, they spend a lot of money now on just trying to get, you know, dig up dirt. I mean, it's been
effective. That's standard operating procedure for all campaigns, Republican or Democrat, or even independent for that matter.
Yeah, and it's just become what they do now, and I don't think it was quite as common in the past. It had to be a more obvious thing, but
well,
you know,
just think Tricky Dick Nixon.
Yeah.
I mean, that's all he did.
I think he kind of was one of the creators of the whole system.
Well, I don't know if he created. I mean, there were, like, you know, Chicago and going back to the previous century, Tammany Hall. I mean, this kind of thing's been going on for quite some time.
Yeah, when they could find it, they would. It's easier to find it now, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
There's more information. But Nixon was amazing. You know, the funny thing about the whole Nixon thing is he did some atrocious things, but it's kind of commonplace now.
I know.
You know, looking at files and that kind of stuff. I mean, geez, what government doesn't do that?
Well, I mean, that's what the Patriot Act is all about. It's just not limiting it to the government files. It's like anybody, we're going to dig it into anybody. It doesn't make any difference.
Yeah, it's legal now.
Oh, whatever happened to the Bill of Rights? I don't know.
I don't know. What is that anyway?
It's an archaic document, right?
Yeah, we deleted it. Delete.
On a sadder note, there was, did you see the video of the judge, the Texas judge, beating his daughter?
Well, I heard you mention that. I mean, who took the video?
The daughter took it. The daughter took the video 7 years ago when she was 16 years old.
Wow.
And he basically takes out a belt and starts whipping her with it. And the reason for it was that she had supposedly been downloading pirated material off the internet, you know, copyrighted songs and that kind of thing.
Oh, you're kidding.
And apparently he also has some very anti-internet views. So you know, he's kind of a backward person in that sense.
But he's
against the idea of even having internet in the house. But the crucial point here is that, of course, he was engaging in what is really, you know, assault and battery and calling it discipline. The video is just, if you're going to look at the video, you can find it on YouTube. The judge's name is Adams, William Adams. He is a court at law judge in Aransas County in Texas. And he does face a police investigation and a judicial conduct probe as a result of the video being released. There are issues that are involved, though, in terms of whether or not he's going to be prosecuted for anything because the daughter waited 7 years to release them, and so now various statutes of limitations problems come into it.
Oh, right.
I did do a little research and found that the statute of limitations for injury to a child with intent, which would be first-degree injury to a child, would still apply, but apparently Texas law has been going through a lot of changes over the years, and it looks like at the time that the event took place, Texas law defined a child as being 14 years old or less, and at the time she was 16 years old.
Hmm.
So the question becomes, does that mean now that she can be treated as an adult at 16?
So it would just be assault or
was battery? Or was she still a minor? I mean, was she in some sort of a no man's land being between 15 and 18? Because if she's an adult, then I would think assault and battery applies. If she's a child, then injury to a child applies. But what if she's in the middle?
Yeah, that's a good point. It's amazing she had the presence to take the video, and it's amazing he kept beating her. Must have known she was taking it?
No, apparently she threw some sort of a veil over the camera quickly because she kind of suspected something like this was going to happen. She has alleged that this has been something that happened ongoing for quite some time.
So she wanted to get a record of it.
And, in fact, it was the reason why she waited so long to release the videotape because she wanted to make sure she was out of the house, her younger sister was out of the house, and her mother was out of the house. Although her mother is now on her side, but on the videotape, her mother was actually on her father's side. The mother was basically egging the father on.
This all stems from the fact that she broke intellectual property law.
Right, exactly. So basically, and the judge's reaction to it, this is like the really sad part, because he's clearly in denial about the whole thing. And where's the quote? I mean, the quote is just really very bad. I don't know if I can find it here, but essentially he said that, yeah, it actually looks worse than it really was.
Oh, I'm sure.
I mean, that's the kind of thing a judge expects a plaintiff to say to him, defendant to say to him, you know. I'm sure you heard a lot of times because apparently the role, it isn't the name of the court that he's in, but apparently the role he's in is very much like a family court. So he's gotten a lot of these cases in the past. So here we have a guy who is actively involved in his own family, whipping his own daughters on a regular basis, hearing cases brought against people on very similar kinds of family domestic charges.
That's amazing.
It is amazing.
It's amazing, and probably without juries most of the time, I would imagine.
Yep, without juries,
cases,
in many
right?
cases. Not all cases, but
no.
And I believe most of the cases he handled were non-criminal. So it would be the lesser type offenses that he was handling.
Right.
But still, it's really quite disturbing. And his response, I still haven't found it here, but his response when the whole thing came out was, first of all, he dared her to release it. He didn't think that she would, and he didn't really care if she did. And he said, you basically don't have the guts to do it, so she did.
Well, good for her.
Him. And his reaction about what happened was, When you see what I was dealing with this very disobedient daughter who was basically violating copyright laws, you understand why I reacted the way I did. I'm sorry I went a little bit too far, but really, I mean, this is very clearly a case where it was a justifiable form of child discipline. That's essentially what his statement said. That is an exact quote. I can't find the exact quote here, but that's basically what he said. And I'm thinking, my God, the things that people will do to justify what is essentially child abuse.
Yeah, it's just aggression. That's all it is.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if an adult, if he had done that to an adult, that's clear assault and battery. I mean,
well,
clear.
It sounds like he'll probably end up in court.
Well, maybe.
I hope
that's
he gets
what,
it.
That's
I
what
hope
the question
it.
Is. I mean, the district attorney there is actually looking at it very carefully because of the delay. They're trying to figure out what statute applies to it. And the video went viral around the world, so the sheriff's office has been fielding calls left and right about the darn thing. But it's all up in the air in terms of whether or not he's actually going to be charged with anything. It's really quite a disturbing story.
Well, you think of the statutes of limitations applied to a child. I mean, a child that's in that kind of situation, what can they do? They have to wait, you know. I mean, and really, there should be no statute of limitations. You know, they have to get out of the house. They're young. They're not going to, you know, bring them to court. You know, seven-year-old's going to bring his dad to court.
And when I was looking at the Texas statutes, it's quite disturbing how many child-related crimes have statutes of limitations of less than 5 years.
Oh.
I mean,
that doesn't
oh
make
my
any
goodness.
Sense. It's not logical.
It's just awful.
Right?
Well, unfortunately, we run out of time, but we've had a good program as usual, so we'll have to pick it up next week. And, Gene, it's been a pleasure.
And we did good even without Jake, who I have to remind the audience, he is still in Hawaii.
He's on honeymoon, too. He didn't even tell us that.
Yeah, well,
the guy got married.
I don't
blame him for
that.
Congratulations, Jake Town, wherever you are. We'll see you all next week here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.